We are in Galatians chapter 2, and we've almost worked our way to the end of the chapter, but we're still a week or two or three away from the end. But we're in verse 20, and we've been in verse 20 a week already. In our last study, we began a consideration of verse 20, because this is Paul's presentation of the reality of what it takes in order for the life of Jesus to be obvious, expressed out of our bodies. And that provision is Christ living in our bodies. It takes the Spirit of Christ in us to manifest the life of Christ out of us. And Paul, in many ways and with many metaphors, has addressed the tension that's there. One of them, for example, with the Corinthians, I believe, he said, we have this treasure in earthen vessels. That means that the earthen vessels sometimes get in the way of the manifestation of the treasure. But nonetheless, the treasure's there, and it can be made manifest. Verse 20 is actually the heart, I think, of the Christian life, and that's why it's here in Galatians, because he's dealing in Galatians with the legitimate faith that results in the experience of life for the person who possesses it, as well as the people who are exposed to the person who possesses it, because every one of us benefit from the life that's in every other one of us as we interact with one another. So, suffice it to say that we have in the past said many times and will continue to say that it takes the Spirit of Jesus to produce the life of Jesus. And that's a fundamental truism that cannot be overstated and it cannot be ignored. In our study last time, we noted that revelation of the life of Jesus begins with an absolute freedom from the law. Verse 19 is very adamant. Through the law, I died to the law so that I could live. So that in order to live, and even the life that he's talking about, the life of Christ living in me and the life I live in the flesh by faith in the Son of God, that life requires that we understand an absolute freedom from the law. We're not under the law in any sense ever. Jesus was under the law for us. That's chapter, 4? That the Son of God came, born of a woman, born under the law, so that he could redeem us from the curse of the law. It's an issue of appreciation in terms of attitude. God is not a judge who is going to apply the law to us. That's not it. When Christ judges us, it will not be by the law. The law's judgment is condemnatory. Christ's judgment is evaluative. In other words, he evaluates what we've done for the purpose of assigning our place in his kingdom based on what comes out of his evaluation of the way we've lived our lives on this earth. So there's a huge difference in terms of attitude. It's the difference between thinking of God as a demanding judge who demands, and you must perform or you're going to get it, and that of a father who disciplines his children, but always for their good, and always for their participation in a greater way in eternity, so that the glory that we participate in eternity is unhindered, except by the lack of growth in our lives in this world. I mean, to the degree that we grow in this world, to that degree we experience the glory that's to come. So that's what's going on in terms of being absolutely free from the law. We cannot approach the life of Jesus being reflected out of us as long as we retain a necessity on our part that's built out of legal demand. That won't work. The issue is proper motivation. And it's impossible for a fallen creature to be properly motivated as long as his or her life is at stake. As long as a fallen creature's life is at stake, he will do, or he or she will do, whatever they think they have to do in order to preserve their life. That's why all of the promises of God are designed to lift the pressure of the threat off. Every promise that God has made is designed to lift certain pressure off of your shoulders. So Paul's argument is that Christ's presence within us directly involves the issue of the capacity for life. The issue is how Christ intends to make his life and truth obvious to others through his disciples with his material absence. When Jesus was here, he had his own body. He reflected the glory of God through his own body, and John says, we beheld his glory. Once he became enfleshed, once he took on a body, we beheld his glory. Well, he left at the resurrection. He ascended. He made his church his new body. We are the church. So it is out of our bodies that he reflects himself into the world. There's an obvious problem. It's obvious that Jesus doesn't get seen very clearly out of our bodies a lot of the time. That wasn't true of his body. His body was in complete submission to the spirit that dwelt in it, his spirit. But our bodies, the submission to the spirit of Jesus in us is kind of off again and on again thing. But the point is, the promise of the indwelling spirit of Christ is at the heart of the gospel. That's how we are united to God in reconciliation. It's how we're born of God. It's how the seed of God abides in us. It's the Spirit of God. The blessing of Abraham was the Spirit of God. We got the Spirit to dwell in our bodies by faith in Christ. So, in this text, verse 20 of Galatians 2, Paul sets forth this idea that Christ lives in him, in his body now. But he also freely admits that there is such a thing as an in-flesh limitation associated with this reality that is rooted in co-crucifixion and co-resurrection. I've been crucified with Christ. I was raised from the dead with Christ. That's the New Testament doctrine. That's what Paul taught. But there is a limitation that exists because the fact that I'm still in this flesh. The realm of co-crucifixion, co-resurrection is spiritual and mental, but it exists in this body. And in this realm, the distinction, the way that the life of Jesus is made manifest from our bodies, is encapsulated by the biblical word faith. Paul said, "The life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God." And in a very real sense, in order for this verse to make any sense at all, you have to see what he's doing. He's declaring that he no longer lives, but that Christ lives in him. But then he admits that there is a human contribution to the process in order for the life to be made manifest. And that human contribution issue is the believing, is the faith issue. If I am dependent, Christ will reveal himself through my body. That's his promise. If I am unbelieving, my unbelief will stimulate behavior out of my body that doesn't reflect Christ, and people won't be able to see him because what they'll see is what my body's doing. And if my body's being driven by unbelieving attitudes or whatever, that's what they're going to see. And that will be a fleshly manifestation that is not Christian, not Christ-like. So what we're going to do this evening is zero in on this issue of Paul's "I live by faith" thing, because I am convinced that we just do not really get this faith thing very well, and there are many, many things that need to be said about it, but for this evening we'll just kind of delve into some perhaps biblical illustrations of the issues of faith and what those implications are. And I want us to start by realizing that Paul is frank in his admission that as long as we're in the flesh, there are going to be problems. He even says in Philippians, "I don't consider myself to having arrived," which means he hasn't really fully released the Spirit of Jesus in his own body. He hadn't arrived. It's interesting how the automatic assumption for almost everybody, believer and unbeliever alike, is that if you claim to be properly related to the Spirit of God or the Spirit of Christ, then all of a sudden you're supposed to be perfect. That's why unbelievers, when you claim you're a Christian, they think you're supposed to be perfect, and then they'll go around looking for ways that you prove you're not. And then they'll say, well, I thought you were a Christian, and yet you do this and this and this and this. Well, fortunately, unfortunately, even believers do that to each other. I thought the Spirit of Christ dwelt in you. Why aren't you letting Him loose? If you were really letting Jesus manifest Himself, you wouldn't be doing this and this and this. It's amazing how as soon as we make this comment that Christ dwells in me and Christ lives in me, then all of a sudden everybody expects me to be perfect. Because my wife's not in here, but she will hear this because she listens to the editing thing. But I'm going to use her as an illustration because when I was editing the last CD, she said, boy, you've really had to edit a lot of stuff, because there were lots of uhs and ands. And so I was cutting all the way through. I said, oh, that's the Spirit of Jesus in me, you know. And she said, if it was the Spirit of Jesus, you wouldn't be making so many mistakes. And I thought, uh-huh, that's exactly what we do. We think that Paul is teaching a manifestation of perfection here. So we need to understand that Paul is admitting in Galatians 2:20 that there is a problem. And the problem is the manifestation of the Spirit of Jesus through the body when the body is still an unredeemed reality. I mean, Paul taught in Romans that we're anticipating with eagerness the redemption of the body. And he's talking there about either the rapture or the resurrection. So there's a frank acknowledgement in Paul's theology that until this body's redeemed, things are not going to be like they ought to be. And it's the body that's a big part of that problem. And it's how we interact with our bodies that's a big part of the problem. So what we want to understand this evening is that Paul is aware of the conflict that exists in the flesh. The life which I now live in the flesh. The reason why it's obvious is in verses 11 through 21, it's indisputable that Paul's scenario in this context is of two believers, and not just that, but two apostles, who both possess the indwelling reality of Christ in them, but they're in sharp conflict with one another over the behavior of Cephas as it bleeds into the doctrinal implications. Cephas is acting like a hypocrite, and he's actually, by his behavior, enforcing the doctrinal precept of legalism, that you must behave a certain way in order to be acceptable to God. And that's heresy, and so Paul confronts it. But what he's confronting is a fellow apostle who also has Jesus dwelling in him. So there's an automatic tension here in this paragraph, and Paul is very frank about the fact that, yeah, it's here. The obvious question is, if Christ is dwelling in Cephas, as he is in Paul, why is Cephas dropping the ball so badly? And that raises the question of just how does Christ make his presence known when we're still caught in this fleshly, unredeemed reality of our fleshliness, our body? How does it work? And Paul frankly says, it's by faith. But what does that mean? Invariably, what we do as believers is we reduce the reality down to some personal responsibility that we have. That's not it. That's not what faith is. For example, if the life of Jesus is not being manifested through my body because of fear, like verse 12, where Cephas, fearing the party of the circumcision, begins to act like a hypocrite, if the issue of fear is what's keeping the life of Jesus made manifest. You know what we will do as believers? We'll say, well, I've got to overcome this fear. Well, have fun. If we could overcome our fears, we wouldn't need any help. It's the fear that drives a lot of this stuff that's going on. And if we could handle the fear, we could handle the stuff. It's kind of like Paul said, if there was a law that could make you alive, then righteousness would be by the law. And what that means is, if you can handle your fears, if you can handle your doubts, I mean, if this is up to you, then do it! And you'll be perfect. That's not faith. The faith approach is not, well, if I can just get over my being afraid, then Jesus can manifest himself through my body. What if we turned that around and said, what if I start trusting Jesus with my fear? What if I just tell him, look, I can't get over this myself. you're never going to manifest yourself through me in this kind of a setting with the fears that I've got about that kind of setting. If you want to make yourself manifest in that setting, then you're going to have to deal with the fear. What if we approached it that way? I really think that that's the faith approach, where we turn the thing over to Him and say, look, this is all, I've already proven that I can't handle this. Every time I run into this, I fall. So if there's a solution, it's got to be you. And I really believe that's the essence of Christ dwelling in my body as the solution. It's not a matter of, okay, God's making this possible if you do what you're supposed to. As long as you put that on there, the freedom for Christ to make Himself manifest doesn't exist. He's limited by our unwillingness to trust Him. Because Paul says, I live by faith. Well, what does that really boil down to? Well, I'd like to set forth some things that we've already talked about in the past in some ways, but this will be just a little bit different approach. So maybe it'll expand our grasp of it. But the first thing I want us to think about is that faith in the Scriptures is fundamentally rooted in a very particular concept. You can't generalize faith into some kind of a general vacuum that means nothing. You all have heard people, if somebody shares the gospel with somebody and says, you know, you're a sinner and you need a solution for your sin, and God sent Christ to pay for your sins, and if you'll trust Him, He'll forgive you, and their immediate response will be, well, I believe in God. And that's supposed to get you off their back. That's supposed to shift the whole thing off because, oh, I believe in God. That's the solution. Well, unfortunately, you have to be an idiot not to believe in God, and that doesn't bring redemption. James says even the demons believe there's a God. And Thomas said the fool has said in his heart no to God, either to him personally or to the idea of God. There's no God. So, you know, other than that little small group of people who are biblically fools for denying that there is a God, even the demons recognize it, but it doesn't save them. You can't just make faith one of these great big empty things. I believe. Whatever. I really believe that the issue of biblical faith is bled dry of its impact by two particular things. One of them is the misuse of the word or the word group. When we use the word faith or believe or belief, when we use it the way our culture encourages us to use it, we subvert our ability to live by faith because we're accepting concepts that are already subverted. For example, we will say in a setting like this, let's say that James told me a couple hours ago that he was going to go down to the store, and then he was going to go by the gas station and fill up his vehicle, and then he was going to stop by a friend's house, and then he was going to come back. So somebody says to me after he's left, do you know where James is? And I say, well, I believe he's at the store. Well, what does I believe he's at the store mean? Yeah, it means it might be and it might not be. In other words, my belief means nothing. I believe he's at the store doesn't mean he's at the store. It means, well, he did say he was going there, but whether he's there now or he's at his friend's house or getting gas or... And that's the way we use the word. That is totally unbiblical. When we say I believe from a biblical point of view, we know this is the fact, and we're stating it as a fact because we believe it. So when we yield to the subversion of the concept by letting the culture define our terms, then we've lost it. We don't even know what we're talking about. You hear these kids, they're going to root for their favorite football team on Friday night, and they go out saying, you got to believe! Well, what? What does that really mean? What if you got to believe as a cheer? What does that mean? Well, it means let's just be as positive as we can that we're going to give it everything we can and that that'll work. But is that really faith? No, because it might not work. The other team might believe too, and then they might beat you. And besides, whose side is God on anyhow? Well, since he's not on either side, you can't believe anything. There's nothing there to believe. And so we use these words. And I think that faith in the scriptures, I think the biblical concept is bled dry by that kind of terminology. Because we no longer have it clear in our mind that when we say, I believe, we're staking something on that. There is something at risk there that we are glad to have at risk there because we know there's no risk there. We believed. When I say that I believe in Jesus, in the faithfulness of Jesus, what I'm telling you is I've staked my soul, my eternal destiny, on the fact that he died in my place after having lived perfectly on this earth. And I have put everything in my future on him, and it's resting there. And I'm perfectly content with that because he's going to take it and run with it. If he doesn't, I'm going to find out that I was believing a lie. But the fact that I believe it means I have settled it. It's done. And that's the biblical concept. So that the first way that faith is bled dry of its impact in our life, and one of the ways that Jesus is kept from manifesting his life through our bodies, is that we've allowed the terminology to get messed up in our heads. The second thing is that I think that faith is bled dry when the application of the words faith, believe, I believe, and you know, to concepts and situations where there's no known linkage. A person claims to believe when he has no idea what God has said about the particulars. Then we are abusing the terminology and the linkage of the concepts as a lie, and therefore we're bereft of any real benefit. If somebody says, you know, I'm really worried that Daryl and Hazel might get in a wreck on the way to Georgetown because they're on the highway all the time, and you know how crazy Daryl is when he's sleepy, and you know how the other people on the highway drive, and I'm just worried to death that they're going to get in a wreck, but I'm going to trust God. What does that mean? Well, normally it means they won't have a wreck because I'm trusting God. Well, then what happens when we have our wreck? What happened? Jesus said, if you believe like the grain of mustard seed, you'll have what you believe. Well, the reason you can't say that is because God never said he was going to protect Daryl and Hazel on the highway. And if he didn't say it, you got nothing to believe. So you can pray for safety for the trip, and you can pray for mercy over us, and you can pray for, you know, that I won't go to sleep when I'm driving, all that kind of stuff. But there is nothing there that you can say, I believe God's going to do thus and so because of my prayer. Because he didn't say he would. And he wasn't unfaithful to you if your prayers don't come out like you ask them. If he didn't say it, he's not committed to it. You can't make him be committed to it just because you ask him to. So that's how the whole idea of faith is bled dry. When we think in terms that are unbiblical, and we can't get away from these unbiblical notions of what it means to trust God. The only way that faith can have the impact that the scriptures assign to it is by particularizing the issues so that there's clarity. In order to believe anything, you have to have a statement that God has made, and you have to understand what he meant by it. And when you understand what he said and what he meant by it, then you can say, okay, I'm going to rest whatever it is he's promised to do. I'm going to rest my expectation fulfillment of that thing squarely on his promise, and then I'm not going to take it up. That's going to be his business. That's what it means to believe. Well, think about what all that means. James opened the letter by his name, James, the book of James in the Bible. James opens that letter with a frank declaration that in order to handle temptation properly in this world, you have to have wisdom. And he says in the opening salvo of his letter, if anybody lacks wisdom, ask, and God will give it. And the whole encouragement there assumes that in order to live effectively, you have to have wisdom, and you may not. But you can if you ask for it, because God will give liberally, and he does not upbraid those who seek it, if they ask in faith. But the point is, the ability to handle attacks against faith require a wisdom that is particularized. You have to understand what the situation is, what God has said about it, and what commitment he may or may not have made in that thing. And if he's made no commitment, you don't got nothing to believe. You just cast yourself on his mercy and hope things will work out. Now, the Bible says you can let your request be made known. There's no hesitation there. But if he hasn't made a commitment in his word about those situations, when you make your request known, you're like Jesus in the garden saying, okay, this is the way I feel about it, but I really want your will. Not my will, but yours. And when you do that, you turn loose of trying to tell God how it's got to come out. Because it's not faith to try to tell God how it's got to come out. Faith is yielding to his will. But the issue is the requirement of wisdom, and the heart of this wisdom issue is a very particular understanding of the situation and how God's words address that situation. If God has made a specific commitment in a given setting, then you can trust him. But if he hasn't, you can't. And the greatest one is the gospel. The situation is our sin. God has said, my son's death for your sin was sufficient to take care of your sin so it can be completely wiped off the map. As far as the law is concerned, you'll never be judged by the law if you put your trust in what my son has done. That's a very specific commitment to a very specific reality. And when you believe him, you get this response where he just wipes your sin out and you're free from the law. So that's the way it works. And the thing that puzzles most of us is that there's just so many things about our living that are not directly addressed like that. What do we do about somebody driving on the highway that we care about and we want them to not have a wreck? Well, we ask the Father to take care of them. But we do it with this understanding that that may not be his particular will in the situation, and therefore my asking is only going to give me peace about the fact that he's in control. That's all it's going to do. That's how the peace of God rules. You just yield to his will, whatever it is, however it comes out. The question is not, God, why'd you let this happen? The question is, and I owe this to somebody I read, but I don't know who it was, so I can't give them credit for it. But the question is not, God, why? It's, God, how do I respond in this situation now so that Jesus can be made manifest through my body? I didn't expect this. I didn't want this. Okay, how do I let Christ manifest himself in this situation that I did not want, did not expect, and yet you've allowed it to happen? That's the real question. Oh, and by the way, this is free because it was free to me. I was reading another book somewhere. I read a lot, and as a consequence, I pick up a lot of stuff, and I never go back and write down the author's name and say, okay, I've got to give this author credit for this, so I'm plagiarizing here, but I'm just telling you, it's not my... But I read recently an eminently quotable quote that I just want to share with you. It doesn't have anything to do with this lesson, and it is this. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. I love that. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. So as long as you're not in the focus, you can operate in humility. That was free. So, if we can start off by saying that the issue in the Bible of faith is a very particularized thing. You know specifically what God has said and how it applies to the situation in which you find yourself in relation to that statement. So that's the beginning. You have to have wisdom to do that, but James says you can have it if you ask for it. The thing that puzzles me about James's promise is that he never tells us how God's going to give us the wisdom we ask for. He just says he will. How will he? When will he? Well, he doesn't answer any of those. He just says, in the situations you find yourself, if you don't know how to respond to it, ask God for wisdom and you'll get it. Now, the implication of that is, in terms of timing, you'll get the answer before you have to act on it. Otherwise, no point in asking for wisdom if you're not going to get it in time. And the second thing is, when you ask, you ought to be alert to a possible answer coming from somewhere. And in that alertness, you will discover that, oh, I think the Bible says this about that. I can trust God about this in this way. Somehow it'll come. It'll be, you know, a song on the radio, or it'll be a sermon, or it'll be in your Bible reading, or it'll be some Christian It might be even an unchristian novel that you're reading or whatever. It doesn't matter. God didn't say, I only use certain methods to give you my wisdom. He just said, I'll give it to you if you ask for it. Now, that's a whole different study. But the point that I'm trying to make here in Galatians 2:20 is that the issue of faith is a wisdom issue, and you have to have the wisdom. But God has made a commitment to providing that. Second thing, not only is faith got to be very specific, cannot be generalized into a vacuous nothing, but the reality of faith is that its impact is determined by the one in whom the faith is focused, not in the one who's exercising it. Did you hear me? The reality of faith is that its impact is determined by the one who made the commitment that you're trusting. It is not you. It's him. Remember Abraham's lesson? He that made the promise will fulfill it. It's his business. If he made the commitment, it's up to him to keep it. My responsibility is simply to expect him to keep it. Let me give you a biblical illustration of how that can be fleshed out. You remember the fiery furnace story in Daniel, where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were three Jewish men, and they had said that they made this commitment in chapter 1 with Daniel that they weren't going to defile themselves, and so they were going to live for God as much as they could. And they were doing so on the basis of Habakkuk's prophecy in Habakkuk that the just by faith would live in regard to the Babylonian invasion and that kind of thing. So they had a promise from God that when the Babylonians invaded, all of those that were justified by faith would survive it. They wouldn't be killed. They might be carried off into Babylon. In fact, they were, a bunch of them. But they wouldn't die. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had gone off into Babylon as captives, understanding that Habakkuk had told them that if they were the justified by faith, then God would preserve their lives from being lost because of the animosity of the Babylonian soldiers and that kind of stuff. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had been elevated in the rulership of the Babylonian kingdom by Nebuchadnezzar. But Nebuchadnezzar had been told by God through Daniel that he wasn't the main honcho in the world, the life of the world. He was one of the kings. And then after him, there'd be another empire, and after him, another empire, and after him, another empire. And Nebuchadnezzar responded in arrogance to that by building the image that basically was gold from the top to the bottom, because in the interpretation of his vision by Daniel, he was just the head of gold. And Nebuchadnezzar's reaction is, no, no. It ain't going to be like the God of heaven says, gold and silver and bronze and iron. It's going to be gold and gold and gold and gold, because I'm it. And I'm going to make it happen by compelling everybody in my kingdom to come together religiously. This is the first ecumenical council, where we're going to get everybody to believe and commit to the same religion. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to build this image 90 feet tall, and we're going to make it all in gold, and it's all going to represent me. And we're going to have everybody in the kingdom who is a ruler in the kingdom subscribe to this religion of the worship of me. So he built the image, and he told everybody, okay, we're going to get together now in this great big wide, you know, panoramic view. We're going to have all the television cameras beaming all across the realm, and everybody's going to see that everybody in Babylon is united in their commitment to Nebuchadnezzar as the king. And so when you hear the music, and that's a whole other thing with the use of music, but when you hear the music, you just fall down and worship the image. And if you don't, we'll just burn you in a furnace of fire. Okay? So everybody's scared to death of being burned in the furnace of fire, because burning hurts. So the music starts and everybody down on their faces. Except Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're out there, standing up there like three sore thumbs, and their enemies say, O king, you got these three Jewish guys out here who will not subscribe to your religion, and they won't fall down and worship your idol, and so you got to get rid of them, because you said everybody had to bow down. And when the king heard it, he was so angry he could chew nails. And he pulled those three guys in and said, Is it true? I'll give you one more chance. And if you'll bow down, fine. But if not, I'm going to heat that furnace up 7 times hotter than that, and you're going to burn. And they said, we're not going to bow to your idol. Our God is able to deliver us, and he will. But even if he doesn't, we're still not going to bow. Oh, this egomaniac just went nuts. So he commanded the furnace to be heated up. And he said to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, there is no God that is able to deliver you out of my hands. And they said, yeah, our God is. And you know what happened to them? The next thing that happened to them was they were tied up in ropes. Can't move. Oh, fine, God. You said you'd deliver us, and our situation just got worse. The next thing that happens to them is these beefy soldiers pick them up. And they're carrying them up the ramp to dump them in the furnace of fire. And these guys are bound, and they're being carried by these humongous soldiers, and they're going to be dumped into this fire, and they can feel the heat of the flames coming. And they're, you know, if they threw them over their shoulder, their feet are getting hot because it's a fire, you know. And they're thinking, oh, God, you said you would not let us be put to death. And here we are on our way into the fire. Do you think for 1 minute that they honestly thought that when they fell into the furnace, the only thing the fire was going to do is burn the ropes off? The thought never entered their minds. It was as big a surprise to them as it was to Nebuchadnezzar when he looked in there and saw him walking around in there with the fourth person that looked like a son of the gods. Well, the reason he looked like that is because he was. The point that I'm trying to make here is they had committed their physical life to the promise of Habakkuk 2:4, and they believed that God would deliver them. They said that. Our God is able to deliver us, and He will. But from there on, everything went south. I don't know what they expected God to do. I mean, I can't even develop a scenario in my mind where they could say, well, God's going to deliver us from this. How in the world is He going to do this? I mean, you can come up with, if they try to put a rope on me, He's going to strike them dead. Well, He didn't. All of a sudden, we're all bound up. Well, if they try to carry us up that ramp, throw us in that fire, He's going to stop them somehow. Well, He didn't. The point that I'm trying to make here is that how God fulfilled His promise to them was up to Him. And I think He surprised even them. Not so much with the fact that they didn't die, but with the method. They came out of the fire without even the smell of smoke on their still unsinged beards. I'd like to have been there. I think that would have been fantastic. But nonetheless, point is, they didn't dream up that solution. God did. And a lot of the time in the Scripture, you'll discover that the biblical issue of faith is last moment, something really surprising. That's the way it works. But the thing that comes clear here is, when God makes a promise, He keeps it. But we can't tell how He's going to do that until He's done it. And then we are standing there with our mouths open thinking, He did it! Out of the gazillion ways that God could have delivered them from Nebuchadnezzar, the only one that He chose to use was just use the fire to burn up the ropes. Then they can just walk around out there in that on that coal bed and just, you know, have a good time until the king says, y'all come out there! And say, who's giving orders here? Well, I guess the king is. Let's go out. Point is, God's the one who determines how He's going to fulfill this promise, and He'll catch us by surprise in terms of method, not in result. I don't think they were surprised that they survived. I think they were surprised by the way they survived. Who would have dreamed that God's method of delivering them was just fireproofing them? So the ropes were all that burned. So that's one of the things I want us to be really, really, really clear on, is that the reality of faith is that its impact is determined by the one in whom we are trusting, not by us. It is not in our wisdom. It is not in our way of figuring. And a lot of times we do get down thinking that, oh, God's promise is going to fail because look what's happening now. It hadn't failed until it fails, folks. And since He's made a commitment, it ain't going to fail. Now, that raises some other issues that I want us to think about in just a few minutes. And that is the second issue. Not only does God determine the outcome or the way it's going to work out, but the arena of the impact diverges somewhat. There is an internal impact and there's an external one. the issue of faith is a twofold thing. One is what happens to the person who believes, and the other is what happens to the people who are around the person who believes. In other words, what's the internal impact of believing, and what's the outworking of the faith outside of the individual? And that varies to extreme, depending on the strength of the faith. Let me pull up an illustration. There's a story in the New Testament about a woman who had an issue of blood for 12 years. She had gone into her monthly cycle, and then for 12 years she just kept leaking blood. It never shut off, and she went to every doctor she could find to try to find a solution medically to her problem, and she couldn't. And for 12 years she was gradually losing her vitality because she was leaking blood all the time. Her body was apparently reproducing almost enough to keep, obviously, 12 years she lived. But the fact is, in the story, this woman, however it happened, got it in her head that if she would touch the hem of Jesus' garment, she would be healed. It was perfectly in harmony with the Old Testament prophecies about what would happen when the Messiah came, because he would heal all their diseases and, you know, raise the dead and cleanse the lepers and all that. So she was within the parameters of biblical revelation in terms of her expectation, except for the precise methodology, touching the garment. But in her head, somehow or another, she had decided that if she could touch it, she'd be made well. And so she pushed her way through a very tightly grouped bunch of, multitude of people, pushing and shoving until she got behind Jesus and reached down and touched the hem of his garment, and boom, she was well. And Jesus turns around and says, "Who touched me?" Because it says he felt the power leave for her healing. And the disciples say, "Are you nuts? Everybody's pushing and shoving. What do you mean, who touched me?" And he looked until he caught the woman's eye. He knew and she knew that he now had identified the woman or the person who had touched him. And she was scared to death. And he told her, "Don't be afraid, your faith has made you well." What does that tell us about her faith? A couple of things that I think are crucial. Number one, her faith is real, and we know it because of the fact that it compelled her behavior. In the Bible, faith always compels the commensurate response. If you believe something, you will respond according to what that thing is. We studied this several months ago. But faith always has a commensurate response, and if the response isn't there, the faith isn't there. So every time in Scripture that there is a faith issue, there is a commensurate response that's tied to the person who believes it. Now this woman believed that if she would touch the hem of his garment, she'd be made well, and she wanted that so badly that in spite of her frailty, in spite of her fear, in spite of her timidity, that's the same thing as fear, but we're just multiplying. In spite of that, in spite of everything, the faith that she had and the desire that she had to be well drove her behavior beyond her fears. It run over her fears. I mean, she was afraid and she was sneaky about it and she was, but the fact is, because she believed that if she could touch it, she'd be made well, man, she was going to touch it. And she may have been just terrified out of her mind, especially when it happened. And then he wants to know who touched me. And she's, she knew she was unclean and she'd made all these people unclean that she'd forced her way through. And now she thinks she's in trouble. And Jesus says, "You're not in trouble. You believed what the Scripture said about me. You believed I was the one. And that faith has created this situation where you got what you wanted." The point that I'm trying to make here is that biblical faith forces a commensurate response in spite of how terrified you are, how hesitant you may be. But what's going on in your soul while you're being compelled by your believing? You're all torn up. You're afraid, you're antsy, but you're still moving. All right? Compare that to the story of the centurion who has this guy in his home household, this slave that's going to die. And so he asked the elders of Israel in Capernaum to go ask Jesus if he'll come and heal his servant. So the elders, because, you know, the guy's a heavy contributor to the synagogue's building fund, they go and say, Jesus, this centurion, he's asked us to ask you to come heal his servant, and he really deserves for you to do this because he's a major contributor. You know, he's a big money guy on our building fund, and he really deserves for you to come and do this. And Jesus is kind of blowing smoke out of his ears thinking, this dessert business is making me sick. But nonetheless, he decides, I'll go do that. And so he turns to go to the centurion's house, and the centurion is waiting at his house to see what Jesus' response to the request that he's made through the elders of the synagogue. And he sees Jesus coming. And then he knows that the answer was, yeah, I'll do that. I'll fulfill the request. So immediately he sends another servant out and says to Jesus, stop. I know that in the Jewish law, Jews are not supposed to come into the houses of Gentiles, and I'm a Roman centurion, and I, you know, if there's anybody unclean, I'm the guy. So don't trouble yourself to come into my house. You don't have to do that. I'm a man of authority. I know what authority means. When I tell somebody who's under me to do something, they do it or else. And when I'm told by somebody over me to do something, I understand this authority thing. And since I believe that you are who you are, I believe that you have the authority. Just say the word, my servant will be healed. And Jesus looks around and he says, you know, I haven't found faith like this in all of Israel. What was the centurion's emotional state after he saw Jesus moving toward his house? And he sent his servant out to tell him, don't come into my house. You don't have to trouble. I mean, you don't have to violate all these rules and regulations and stuff. Just say the word and it'll be done. I understand authority. What was his emotional state with such great faith? He might have been up in the air wondering until he saw Jesus moving in his direction. But once he saw that, he knew the answer had been, yeah, I'll come and do that that's been requested. And as soon as he knew that, he was satisfied. It's going to be done. Compare that to the woman. Jesus says so great faith he's never seen in Israel of a Gentile centurion. And to a Jewish woman, he says, don't be afraid. The point that I'm trying to make is that the Bible recognizes that there will be a difference in the impact on you in response to faith, depending on how great it is. The greater your confidence is, the less emotional turmoil you will have. The lesser your confidence is, the more turmoil you'll have. But the fact is, you have the confidence. It may be just that tiny, but it'll drive you to pursue. And being that tiny, you'll pursue with fear and trepidation and all kinds of problems. But nonetheless, you'll pursue because it's a commensurate response issue. But if you have faith like the centurion, you'll just say, okay, I turned that over to God and it's his to deal with. And you'll go on about your rat killing because you trust him. Well, that's the difference between great faith and little faith. But the fact is, that's a difference in terms of relative impact on you. But the fact out of that is that once we understand that there is this about faith, that the more a person understands the issues and how truth functions, the easier it will be on us. Once we understand that, then we can turn this whole issue of impact over to God, and we will become more and more like the centurion because the growth of faith is incipient. The more we trust, the more we see that it's worthwhile to trust, and the greater our confidence grows. But this increase of faith is incipient. It means step by step by step. But it also is often challenged by these deceptions that come along. Our God will deliver us. Tie them up. Our God will deliver us. Carry them up. Our God will deliver us. Throw them in. Our God delivered us. So I want you to understand that on the inside, when you trust, what trust will do is it'll motivate your behavior. It will produce the commensurate response of faith. But it may not put your soul at rest. Depends on how much confidence you have in the reality. The greater the confidence, the more your soul's at peace. But the other impact that God determines, and that is outside of us. We're talking about Christ making himself known outside of us. The life of Jesus being manifest through our bodies by the Spirit of Jesus within our bodies. Well, if somebody sees somebody really shaky and fearful and all that, how much of Jesus are they seeing? Not much. They're seeing the little bit that is producing the commensurate response, but that's all they're seeing. But what if you have this real sense of peace, and well, then they're going to see a lot more of Jesus, because that's his character. So what happens on the outside, beyond the body? Well, that also, that's beyond your own circumstances or control. And what happens in the world of men and angels because of what you believe is another one of those things that God has not put into your control. How other people are affected by your manifestation of the life of Jesus through your body is not your business, because you can't control it. Paul went and he preached the gospel. He wanted people to believe it. He wanted them to be saved. Well, a lot of times that didn't happen. He got beaten and he got thrown in jail and all kinds of bad stuff happened. And it wasn't what he wanted. But God has never put the issue of what he's going to do in the lives of other people in our hands. He has said, I'll reflect the life of my son through your body if you'll trust me, but you cannot decide ahead of time whether you're going to trust me if this is going to be the result. No. You get your hands off of that. 1 Corinthians 3:6 says, some sow, some water, but God gives increase, and he's never going to turn that job of producing the increase over to one of us. It ain't going to happen. You can't tell God, well, I'll let Jesus manifest himself through my body as long as this is the result. Forget it. You're already off into the delusion of your own control over God there. And it's a delusion. It's not faith. God has never turned what he's going to do in the lives of others through the manifestation of Jesus out of your body. He's not put that in your hands. It's out of your control. He will always do what he said he would do, but after that, it's completely up to him. It's at his discretion. And it may disappoint us. There may be a lot of grief in it, but there may be high joy too, because we really didn't expect that. And yet it happened. But the scriptures say that God's judgments are unsearchable and his ways are past finding out. So it's a ludicrous thing for men to judge the events outside of their bodies in terms of whether God is being faithful or not. The promise is God will manifest the life of his son through our bodies if we'll trust him. That's the promise. What does that mean? Well, that depends. And God hasn't said what it means. So the real issue for us in terms of the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God. That faith means that I'm going to depend on God to do what he said he would do in manifesting the life of his Son through my body, but I am not going to condition that and decide on whether or not that really is being fulfilled by what I see other people responding in terms of. I can't decide it that way. I think it's an extremely necessary lesson to learn. I think that a lot of the head counting and the hand counting and all of the money counting and a lot of the things that we decide whether we're being successful for God by, if we're really letting Jesus live through our bodies, then how are we going to measure it? Well, we'll measure it by this and this and this. No, you won't. The only way you can measure it is if God has made a specific promise and the life of Jesus is manifest through your body in line with that promise and circumstance, then you know what to expect because the Bible says. But more times than not, that door's not even been opened to us, to be honest. The challenge for us is to let the life of Jesus be manifest. And we do that when we trust him to do it. The promise is he'll do it if we'll trust him. Early on, we may have all kinds of, but the fact is, as we're trusting, Jesus will manifest himself. And the more it happens, the more confident we'll become that it will happen. In short, the Apostle Paul's permission of the manifestation of Jesus through his body by faith resulted in an inerrant, inspired, infallible letter to the Galatians. That was one of the things that was produced. Jesus in his body produced this letter to the Galatians. Did it make Paul perfect? No, but it made the letter perfect. In the process, we don't determine whether God's being faithful or not to his promise by things that are out there that are beyond his statements. Otherwise, I mean, if he said what he'll do, he'll do it, and we'll see it done. But how much of your life do you suppose is really covered by specific proclamation, specific declaration? If you do this, this is going to happen. Most of the times, not. There's just too much of life 24/7 that's too generalized. We don't know what's going to happen. But that doesn't mean that we should hesitate to tell God every morning, look, this is your body. You want to make yourself manifest. You want to reflect your son's life through this body. This body's yours. Just do it. I'll depend on you. That's the issue. And I really do think that that's at the core of the manifestation of life, is a willingness on our parts to say, that's what you're committed to do. I'm making my body available. Do it. Okay? Comments, questions?
How do you practically, we're not perfect, so how do you get your flesh out of the scenario? I mean, you say, okay, Lord, I give this to you. I trust that you're going to manifest yourself out of me. But then how do you get yourself out of the way so that you don't get in the middle and act the way you want to act? The way he wants you to act.
Do you hear what you're asking me?
No.
You're asking me, how do I do this? How do I control this process? How do I get myself out of the way? The answer, in short, is you can't. You have to say to Jesus, you know how I am. If you want to make yourself manifest through me, then that's your commitment. Just do it. It's up to you to do it. In the meantime, we have to wrestle with the fact that he responds to the things that we believe. And he also responds to the things we don't believe. And so in the areas of our lives where we don't believe certain things, he is not going to be able to manifest himself in those areas because we haven't trusted the issues yet. We might not even know what they are. So that's why the tension is there. He will manifest his life through me in the areas where he's made commitment and I believe him and I'm trusting him to do this. Jesus is going to do this through my body. But there are these other and no individual decision is free of a lot of other decisions. And all of those have to be informed either by faith or unbelief. And it depends on how well we know the scriptures. So that's the reason why the Bible presents the life of Jesus being made manifest as an incremental thing, because it regularly hinges on whether I'm trusting him in enough of the areas of the decision making so that he's free. He's really free. Let me see if I can illustrate it in a way that might make sense. I'm going to pick on some things, so I'll be stepping on some toes around. Maybe not in here, but let's say the preacher decides that God wants him to be a preacher. So he yields to the thing about becoming a preacher. Okay, in that one area, he believes that God wants him to be a preacher, so he's yielded to that. But let's say that the guy is really a body-focused, kind of fleshly focused kind of person. He's very much into satisfying the flesh. So he eats too much and he satisfies his other fleshly appetites too much. His ability to preach the word with power and conviction is going to be hampered by his unbelief and his unknowledgeable commitment of his appetites to the control of Jesus. And because he doesn't even know that's happening, it's messing up the picture of Jesus that's coming out of that body. Because of these other things. And let's say that in spite of those things, he becomes effective and he starts preaching to more and more people because they're coming to listen for whatever reason. I mean, we all know big fat preachers that have 16,000 people that listen to them every Sunday. I mean, you know. So the appetite really doesn't matter to them. But let's say that in his philosophy of being a preacher and a successful one, then there are these budgetary things. And so because he doesn't understand some of the biblical concepts of how ministry should be financed, he just does it the way he thinks it ought to be done. And that compromises the picture of Jesus in his life. You see what I'm saying? So Jesus will manifest himself through our bodies to the degree that we're trusting in the areas of where we know. That's why a clear conscience is the crucial issue. God does not demand perfection of me or anything of me except the willingness to trust Him. And then, over time, He will expose to us the things that we're not trusting Him in and say, "Now, I want you to start trusting me here." I'm not telling you I want you to get over your fear. I'm not telling you you have to control your gluttony. I'm not telling you that you have to control your desire to be the center of attention. I'm not telling you you have to control it. I'm just telling you that these are areas that are weaknesses and you have to start trusting me here. And when you trust me, I control them. And then the picture of Jesus gets clearer as we get more and more under the awareness of what we're depending on Him to do. And really, there are only three things. Baptize the flesh, baptize the soul, and baptize the spirit. But the problem with those three things is just like the color spectrum. There's blue and red and yellow. But there are a gazillion shades of all this mix. And in the area of trust and promises and all that, the book is really thick because you can take these three things and mix and mingle, and Satan is a master at this, so he confuses the whole issue. So it takes a lot of words to explain and get us out of the mix of the deceptions. And so the life of Jesus is a gradually increasing reality as our understanding of what He said increases, and we're able to say with confidence, "Okay, He said this, I believe it. I'm going to act on it." Happens. Does that help? Mm-hmm. We have to get rid of the notion that it's up to me to do any more than simply turn it over to Him and yield to His dominion so that I'm trusting Him. As soon as I have to dominate my fear, I have to believe Him. As long as it's I have to, Jesus isn't being manifest, you are. I don't know if that's...
No, it does. It's just...
Like I said, there's a gazillion colors. Yeah. It's a very big picture. Most of us want to be more perfect than we are, and that's a good thing. We just have to realize that in order to get to be like Jesus, it's going to take a whole life and then a rapture or a resurrection in order to complete it. So we trust Him to do what He wants with us today. And tomorrow maybe it'll be a little bit more because we have an experience that enables us to be more confident. Tomorrow, the day after, it's on.